KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Surrender your weapons and yourselves before it's too late.
Violent killings in Syria are threatening the fragile coalition put together by the country's new government. For Saturday, March 8th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, the latest on a new plan by House Republicans to avert a government shutdown, and a look at Marco Rubio's track record so far as Secretary of State.
What it means for policy is that don't look to Marco Rubio as an indicator for what foreign policy is going to look like.
Plus, what it's like to cover Elon Musk, 2 a.m. emails and all. And we'll talk to singer-songwriter Jason Isbell about his brand new album, which gets pretty personal.
I wanted to walk into a studio in the Village with a single guitar and a notebook and come out of there with an album.
Those stories and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. President Trump is urging congressional Republicans to pass a temporary government funding bill in hopes of avoiding a government shutdown. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
The government shuts down Friday night if a spending bill isn't passed. And with Republicans in control of both the House and the Senate, Trump wrote on Truth Social, quote, "We have to remain united, no dissent. Fight for another day when the timing is right." His argument is that although this measure punts the deep spending cuts conservatives want, it buys time for Republicans to pass what he really wants: big tax cuts and bulked up spending on immigration enforcement. Democrats are already rallying against it, saying it hands too much power over to the White House to determine which programs are cut. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Palm Beach, Florida.
Ukrainian officials say at least 14 people were killed in Russian aerial attacks overnight. It was the second night of heavy Russian bombardment since the U.S. stopped sharing satellite images with Ukraine, significantly reducing its ability to defend itself. It's part of the Trump administration's freeze on intelligence sharing with Ukraine. NPR's Joanna Kakissis has more.
Maxar Technologies provides satellite images and geospatial data to the U.S. and other nations through contracts. Maxar said in a statement that the U.S. government has suspended Ukrainian accounts in a program that provides commercial satellite imagery. In a statement on Telegram, the Ukrainian cyber community site Cyberborochno said users in this program got access to information that helped track the movement of Russian forces and Russia's use of strategic facilities. Meanwhile, Starlink helps the Ukrainian military communicate and spot Russian drones. The French satellite service Eutelsat is offering to replace Starlink in Ukraine. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is asking the healthcare community to look out for ailments involving rash and fevers. This amid a measles outbreak in Texas and New Mexico. NPR's Maria Godoy reports.
The CDC says thanks to high vaccination rates and strong surveillance programs, the risk for widespread measles in the United States remains low. It emphasizes that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine remains the most important tool for preventing measles. The agency is urging all U.S. residents to make sure they're up to date with their measles vaccinations, especially before traveling anywhere internationally. That includes infants 6 months or older who are traveling abroad. The CDC says teens and adults in areas with an ongoing measles outbreak who previously only got one dose of measles vaccine should get a second dose. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. South Korea's impeached president has returned to the presidential residence from jail after a court canceled his detention. NPR's Sewon Gong reports he's charged with committing insurrection after declaring martial law in December.
President Yoon Suk-yeol left Seoul Detention Center in a motorcade 52 days after he was arrested over insurrection charges. A court in Seoul ruled on Friday that his detention was invalid because of procedural flaws. Prosecutors decided not to appeal the decision. Saturday, Yoon stepped out of his car before he left the detention center. He waved to his supporters gathered near an entrance and clenched his fist. He will still stand trial on criminal charges for disrupting South Korea's constitutional order. Separately, the Constitutional Court is expected to rule on his impeachment soon and decide whether he should be removed from office. Seo Eun-kwong, NPR News, Seoul.
Most Americans are setting their clocks ahead this weekend, losing an hour of sleep in the morning, but adding more evening sunlight. This is the spring ahead phase of time change. In the U.S., every state except Hawaii and Arizona observes daylight saving time. Europe, much of Canada, and part of Australia also implement it. Russia and Asia do not. Lencia Cabetta made history this week on Broadway, becoming the first Black actor to assume the role of Elphaba full-time in the Broadway company of Wicked. Cabetta has been touring with Hamilton. She is a first-generation Ethiopian-American from L.A. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. In Syria, hundreds of people, many believed to be civilians, are dead in what are believed to be revenge killings by armed fighters. Those fighters rushed into coastal communities after an earlier ambush of government forces by other gunmen loyal to the former regime. This is all the biggest challenge to the new Syrian government since it took power last December. NPR's Jane Araf joins us from Damascus with the latest. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Scott.
We're talking about attacks and counterattacks and retaliatory attacks. Walk us through what all is happening here.
So this took place on Syria's Mediterranean coast in the provinces of Latakia and Tartus. And those are a traditional base of support for former President Bashar al-Assad, who fled the country in December. There was an ambush of government forces on Thursday, and then government rushed in reinforcements, and then other armed groups joined in. Many of those were Sunni Islamist militant groups. The targets of what appear to be revenge killings are mostly members of the Alawite minority. That's an offshoot of Shia Islam that al-Assad belonged to. Now, Scott, the numbers are unknown. It's really hard to verify, but human rights monitoring groups say there are hundreds of victims, and it is being called a massacre.
Wow. How is the government responding?
Well, Interim President Ahmed Ashara addressed Syrians. He told former regime fighters to give up before it's too late, and he pledged to put all weapons in the hands of the state. Today, government forces sealed off some of those communities and said they were restoring order. They called the killings individual actions rather than connected to the government, but Alawites and other minorities don't believe it.
I mean, Jane, the people who had been in charge of Syria for decades have suddenly been deposed in recent months. This is a tentative new government. How serious is all of this?
It is really serious. It's the biggest threat to the new Syrian government since it took power. I mean, Ashara is trying to knit together a multi-sectarian, multi-ethnic country, very heavily armed, lots of different groups, and he needs to unify security forces. There's a vacuum at the moment. There aren't enough of them. The country is struggling with sanctions. There's no police force or army. There's no money to pay them. It's a big, big, big problem.
How are Syrians and other parts of the country responding to this?
Well, Syria is emerging from 12 years of civil war under the old regime. And the fears, of course, are that this could spiral into civil war again. There are also deep concerns that other countries could be brought in, Iraqi militias to protect Alawites. Israel has said it will protect the Druze minority. And in Soweto today, the Druze heartland, we met the commander of the new Soweto Military Council, coalition of fighters. Tariq Ashoufi told us they believe that after the Alawites, the Druze will be the next targets. He said, once they finish on the coast, they will come for the Druze. The threats are clear. And he said they would accept help from Israel or any other country. So after that, we went to a meeting of men from surrounding villages where the commander told them they were taking volunteers to uphold the dignity of the Druze and protect their land. And it ended with a traditional Druze dance. Now, this is a dance that's done at celebrations and other significant events, but this time it felt very much like a war cry.
That is NPR's Jane Arraf. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It has been a little more than a week since Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met with President Donald Trump in the Oval Office. Vice President J.D. Vance was in the meeting, too, and so was Secretary of State Marco Rubio. The nation's top diplomat was sitting on an Oval Office couch, mostly silent, as Trump and Vance berated the Ukrainian leader and in the process made it clear just how much of the established global order they are ready to upend. An order that for most of his career, Rubio has defended and worked to help hold up. So what changed and what do those changes mean? To answer these questions, we're going to talk to Professor of International Politics at Tufts University's Fletcher School, Daniel Dresner. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start by rewinding just a little bit. You wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times about Rubio's political evolution back in December before he took office. And you asked which Marco Rubio is going to show up for the job, the democracy-promoting optimist or a more inward-looking anti-global pessimist? A month in, do you feel like you have a verdict?
Oh, yeah, it seems pretty obvious. The Rubio that's shown up is the one that will defer to Trump's America First image, the one that will close embassies and consulates, the one that, according to widespread reports, has yet to really push back on any of Trump's foreign policy instincts.
Does that surprise you?
Not really. You know, Marco Rubio did articulate a more democracy-promoting, human rights-promoting foreign policy vision when he ran for president in 2016, and he lost. And he not only lost, but Donald Trump humiliated him in a lot of ways on the campaign stage. Rubio is a lot of things, but one thing is a political survivor, and he survived Trump's first term and has managed to get into the good graces of Trump over the last 10 years. And the way he survived is by altering his worldview. He has demonstrated tremendous ideological flexibility, and by doing so was, you know, considered for vice president and eventually was given the Secretary of State position. And I'm sure Rubio thought of this as potentially a stepping stone to run for president again, or certainly, you know, an action that would give him the prestige of traditional secretaries of state.
You know, Marco Rubio is not the only Republican by far to change big positions and align them with what President Trump is promoting. But I think this particular issue of Ukraine, and you have that visual that rocketed around the internet, yeah, of Rubio kind of slumped into the couch, almost high, like absorbing into the couch, like the Homer Simpson meme, you know?
Yes, yes.
Like this particular issue of Ukraine, Rubio and so many other Republicans were so out there in terms of defending this country, standing up for this country, making sure the United States was continuing to fund this country. Then you see how he tweets about what happened in the Oval Office afterwards, saying President Trump was standing up for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That particular issue, I feel like, is a hard one to square. How do you feel about it?
I think there are two things about Rubio that make it particularly noticeable for him. The first is that, as that Oval Office meeting demonstrated, he has the world's worst poker face. It was obvious that this was not something he wanted to see happen. Anyone looking at the body language could tell why that is. And because Rubio's smart enough to know what the implications were of Trump berating Zelensky in the Oval Office. You know, to be fair, Rubio did vote against Ukraine aid back in 2024, mm-hmm, because of claims that you wanted to prioritize focus on the southern border.
Mm-hmm. There's this long line of various high-profile cabinet secretaries who more traditional Republicans hope can be a moderating influence. I think the first Secretary of State under Trump, Rex Tillerson, is a good example of that. And he ended, yep, up being humiliated when he was fired and, yep, and then mocked by President Trump and others in the administration. How much influence can you have over foreign policy when you're a Secretary of State who is not seemingly one of the key decision makers in the presidency?
Not much. It doesn't end well. Secretaries of State, in some ways, whether they are considered influential or not, is in part a function of the relationship and trust they have with the president. This is how James Baker was considered an outstanding Secretary of State under George H.W. Bush, for example, or George Shultz to some extent under Ronald Reagan. On the other hand, Secretaries of State who have been considered on the outside looking in, like let's say Colin Powell during George W. Bush's first term, generally are not given high marks by historians. And so the problem that Rubio has is not just that he has little influence, it's that if he tried to exercise any influence, Trump would probably tweet just a long list of scorn headed towards Rubio or fire him.
So what does that mean for policy?
What it means for policy is that don't look to Marco Rubio as an indicator for what foreign policy is going to look like. Marco Rubio will be the endorser. He will try to perhaps, you know, offer a patina of rationality for why Trump is doing what he's doing. But the truth is that in this administration, foreign policy is being run from the White House and in particular the Oval Office.
It's Daniel Dresner, professor of international politics at Tufts University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jazz funk pioneer Roy Ayers died earlier this week after a long illness. He was 84 years old. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has the story.
Roy Ayers started vibing early. Here's a story he liked to tell. When he was 5 years old, his family took him to a concert by the vibraphonist Lionel Hampton. Ayers grooved so hard that Hampton handed him his first pair of mallets. When Ayers himself took up the vibes, it was in LA's hard bop scene in the 1960s. He mixed jazz improvisation with sunlit funk grooves and bright horns. In 1976, he struck gold with the song Everybody Loves the Sunshine.
My life, my life, my life, my life in the sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine.
Ayers spoke about his signature hit decades later on a TV interview with UK journalist Sonia Saul.
I was inspired by my upbringing in Los Angeles, California, when there was no smog. And that's what really inspired me to compose that song.
Ayers, in turn, inspired generations. Everybody Loves the Sunshine alone has been sampled more than 100 times. Ayers also collaborated with younger artists like Tyler, the Creator. In a PBS interview, Tyler said he grew up listening to Ayers' music, and he was honored to work with someone he considered a legend.
I sent him the song I wanted him on, and he called me and was just like, oh, young man, oh, Tyler, these changes, they cold, man. These chords are cold.
Roy Ayers kept the vibes going, collaborating and releasing new music until the last decade of his life. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
My life, my life, my life, my life, and the sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Luis Chiavone with these headlines. House Republicans are proposing 99 pages of federal government funding extensions as a deadline for action closes in. The plan released today would fund the government through September 30th. For two nights, Russia has launched heavy aerial attacks on Ukraine with multiple fatalities. This as the U.S. has stopped sharing satellite images with Ukraine. On social media, Polish President Donald Tusk said, "This is what happens when someone appeases barbarians." In Syria, international human rights observers say at least 1,000 people have died over the past 2 days, and clashes between security forces and loyalists of ousted Syrian President Assad. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. It was a single line in a State Department budget spreadsheet, $400 million to purchase armored vehicles from Tesla.
Having ambassadors and dignitaries around the world, you know, driving around in armored Cybertrucks, I mean, that would really be a pretty remarkable thing.
That's Bobby Allen, an NPR tech reporter who has covered Elon Musk for years. It would be a remarkable thing because Musk is both a Trump administration advisor and, as the CEO of Tesla, the would-be beneficiary of that $400 million windfall.
We got a statement from the State Department that basically said, oh, yeah, this started in the Biden administration and we've canceled this contract. Don't worry about it. But, you know, I got a note from somebody saying, you know, I'm in a position to know this is incorrect.
The source had a document, but they were hesitant to share it.
They're terrified, Scott. I mean, this person fears retaliation. They fear threats against them, threats against their family. They fear lawsuits. I mean, nobody really wants to cross someone like Elon Musk.
And that began the delicate dance that happens between sources and reporters. It took 5 or 6 phone calls before Bobby could even convince the source to share their identity. And even then, the source didn't want to send the document digitally. So Bobby went analog.
So we had a colleague at NPR, Scott, drive to this person's house, get a copy of the document, scan it in, and then send it to me, and I got it. And the document showed definitively that the Biden administration had not set aside $400 million for Tesla, but the entire EV budget for the State Department was somewhere in the ballpark of $400,000.
And all of that provides a small window into the process of reporting on the fire hose of news coming out of the Trump administration. This is a very specific kind of journalism, one that relies on trust building and access. So today, for our weekly Reporter's Notebook segment, we are going to jump into that world with Bobby Allen, a reporter who loves to fight for a scoop.
You talk to journalists and they like different parts of the job. Some people love the reporting. Some people love the writing. Some people, if you're a broadcast journalist, you know, like being live. The thing that I really relish is the negotiation with the source to get information. As soon as I hear that a source has something and they might be reluctant to give it, my reporterly spidey sense just kind of goes off. And yeah. I just really home in on it. And I'm like, how can I get this person to either give me this information or give me the document? And it's a process. And this does kind of tap into, I think, you know, part of my personal history. I come from a family of car salespeople in rural Pennsylvania. And growing up, I just was constantly hearing about deals closing, negotiation, how you charm someone, how you get them to leave the lot with a car. And me as a journalist, I'm like, how can I leave this conversation
with a document?
It might sound absurd, but to me, there's some kind of connection there.
It's a low APR on that document. Don't worry
exactly.
About it. So, Bobby, you've covered tech for a long time. You've covered Elon Musk for a long time. How has Doge and this big presence of this storyline changed your reporting and your focus?
Well, I'm now a government reporter. I never thought I would be. Right? I've been focusing, as you mentioned, on the tech industry and Elon Musk for some time. And I went from just writing about Silicon Valley to trying to understand, you know, how Washington works. Yeah. And I think a lot of tech reporters are scratching their heads and, like, you know, learning just how complicated it is to be a Washington reporter. I have a new appreciation for it.
I want to, when it comes to covering Elon Musk, I want to talk about a very particular incident that you had covering him. Let's set the stage. It's the fall of 2022. Elon Musk has just bought Twitter for some $40 billion, right? Pick up the story from there.
Right. He takes the platform over and unleashes a set of changes that are whiplash-inducing, including blue checks. You know, the verified blue check now is something you can buy. And that led to all of these incidents of, you know, huge companies being impersonated by folks who were paying for a blue check and causing all sorts of havoc. The reinstatement of sort of far-right figures like Alex Jones and a number of other individuals who were banned from the platform being brought back. He affixed on NPR's Twitter account a label that suggested that we were a state-owned media. A number of changes that led the network, and again, Scott, you and I had nothing to do with this decision, just pointing that out there, but NPR decided to not participate in Twitter anymore. And during this time, as a business reporter, I was communicating with Elon, and at one point I said, why did you affix this state-affiliated media label to NPR? I mean, surely you know that, like, 1% of our budget is government funding, 99% is it? I mean, where is this coming from?
And I should say these interactions were over email mostly,
All over email. And he made a threat to me. And he said, if NPR doesn't come back to Twitter, I'm going to, this is not an exact quote, but this was the spirit of it, I'm going to basically hold an auction and give at NPR to the highest bidder. And I said, oh, that's weird. And then I took a beat, Scott, and I was like, wait, is the richest man in the world making a threat to me? Is he basically blackmailing me and saying, if the company I work for, if my employer doesn't do something to benefit his company, he's going to retaliate? And I said, hey, I think that's a news story, right?
Yeah.
So I write it up as a news story, 2:03 a.m. That night, I get an email from him with the subject line, you suck, nothing in the body.
How'd that make you feel?
Well, it's what Elon Musk biographer Walter Isaacson calls Elon demon mode. There are many Elons, right? I think this was a good illustration of demon mode, meaning this, like, kind of mean-spirited, kind of childish, impulsive kind of part of him that sometimes takes over. I mean, I kind of chuckled. I didn't really upset me, but I thought, this is unexpected. I mean, it was surprised. I was kind of shocked, but at the same time, I'm like, you suck, really? I mean, are we 10 years old on a school playground? I mean, how pathetic is this, right? I mean...
What, if anything, from that period of time helps you understand what Elon Musk is doing in his position of power right now?
Yeah, I mean, what that whole saga illustrated is just how many versions of Elon there really are. What you're often seeing on X is the demon mode, right? Is this very sort of childish, impulsive kind of version of Elon who's sharing memes and criticizing people and spreading silliness or spreading disinformation. But there's another side of him too. I mean, he does have a certain amount of engineering genius to him, right? I mean, he's the richest man in the world for a reason, right? He does have, when it comes to material sciences, when it comes to engineering, he has a really special mind, but he's also just like the most impulsive person I have ever dealt with. And I think that's important to dwell on in this moment. People are always asking me, Elon Musk just did this controversial thing that's grabbing headlines. What is his end goal? And sometimes with Elon, he doesn't quite know, right? He's operating in the moment. It's this id-driven kind of thing. And what he thinks and how he feels today might change in 24 hours. This is just being part of the Elon Musk vortex. And it's full of mayhem, and it's full of constantly being confused and trying to make sense of it, but that's what it is.
Given all of that, there has been so much obsession on understanding his political transformation. Mm-hmm. Do you see him as a different person, or in the end, is this just the same dude who sent you a 2 a.m. email telling you that you suck.
Right. I think there were a number of radicalizing events for Elon Musk. One of them was during the pandemic and the COVID lockdowns that shut down his Tesla plants. He was very angry about that. Another was what he saw as sort of the aperture of free speech closing on Twitter. And we could debate the merits of that some other time. But to Elon Musk, liberals started dominating the conversation and the dialogue and the shape of the discourse on Twitter. And that was so upsetting to him that he wanted to buy the platform and upend all of the rules. But what he does have is this almost addiction to risk, an addiction to proving people wrong. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that play out in the White House now. It's like USAID. Some are saying 20% of this agency should be reduced. And he says, why don't we try to reduce it right down to its studs, nearly dismantle the entire agency? I mean, when somebody makes a proposal, he tries to go way, way, way farther, to the point where many people will see this and say, this is unfathomable, this can't be done. And Elon will say, let me prove you wrong.
That is NPR's Bobby Allen, tech reporter, who now covers Doge for us, pulling back the curtain on his reporting. Bobby, I just want to say you don't suck. I think actually you're pretty great.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks. Appreciate you.
Healthcare coverage for millions of Americans could be in jeopardy under proposals in Congress that would cut the program known as Medicaid expansion. Now, in both Democrat and Republican-led states, leaders worry they will get stuck with more of the cost or that they'll have to kick people off of coverage. One state with a particular dilemma could be Missouri. We're joined now by St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum. Hey there.
Thank you for having me.
Jason, let's start with this nationally. How many people are we talking about across the U.S. who rely on this program, and what does it do for them?
There are more than 20 million Americans who currently get health care coverage through Medicaid expansion. And that was a key part of the Affordable Care Act under the Obama administration, where the federal government picked up 90% of the costs to cover the working poor, like individuals making about $21,597 a year. Mm-hmm. Most states signed up for this plan, including Missouri, where voters passed a constitutional amendment implementing Medicaid expansion in 2020. And so backers of Medicaid expansion say it helps keep rural hospitals afloat by cutting down on uncompensated care for the poor. And they also say it incentivizes people in the program to go to the doctor earlier before health problems become deadly and cost more money.
So let's say that these proposals do go into law. The federal government cuts the 90% it pays now. What are leaders in Missouri worried would happen next?
They're worried because there are more than 300,000 people in Missouri covered by Medicaid expansion. And as I mentioned earlier, Medicaid expansion is in the Missouri Constitution. Cutting people off of the program would likely need another statewide vote. And if it remains in the Constitution, Missouri budget leaders say it could lead to a budgetary hole in the hundreds of millions of dollars. We even saw Missouri GOP Senator Josh Hawley warn against Medicaid cuts in the budget process. He says basically it could backfire politically, even upsetting Republican voters.
So Missouri, as you're talking about, has this particular problem. Let's talk more broadly. What are other states doing about this?
I spoke with Robin Ritowitz of KFF, a nonprofit health policy research polling and news organization. She noted that 12 states have so-called trigger provisions ending or reducing coverage for the Medicaid expansion pool if the federal government ends that 90-10 match. And she says lots of states could face cutting people off of the program.
States would then need to say, well, am I going to increase my revenue? So increase taxes? Can I cut education? That's the biggest piece of state budgets. Or do I have to make cuts to my Medicaid program, which could involve rolling back coverage, lowering provider rates, or limiting benefits, all of which would restrict access.
And this would affect GOP-dominated states quite a bit. KFF found that more than 780,000 people in deep red Louisiana, where House Speaker Mike Johnson is from, are covered under Medicaid expansion, and millions more are encompassed in states President Trump won last year, such as Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Arizona, and Indiana.
You look at political history, and there's a pretty clear track record here that when benefits like this are cut, it's politically unpopular. Where does this stand politically at this point in time?
It's not clear that Republicans in Congress are going to cut Medicaid expansion, but some GOP lawmakers and think tanks contend that Medicaid is too expensive and complicated. People are on it who shouldn't be eligible. In other words, fraud, but the extent of that is widely disputed, especially with demand among GOP lawmakers for big budget cuts. Eliminating the Medicaid federal match could be attractive to them.
That's Jason Rosenbaum from St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. House Republicans have unveiled their plan to keep the government funded through September. President Trump backs the bill, and House Democrats have already said they will oppose it. And here to talk about it is NPR's Eric McDaniel. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Scott.
What's in it?
Well, let's start here. You might have heard about President Trump's talking about his one big, beautiful bill with all of his priorities.
Mm-hmm.
This is not that. I also want to say it's not a change to the biggies, Social Security and Medicare. Those get their funding continued automatically. What it is sort of clearing House Republicans' to-do list in order to focus on Trump's priorities, basically keeping the lights on through the fall while they focus on the policy stuff. But it is interesting as far as stopgap measures go. Like most extensions, it keeps funding basically unchanged, but this time they're increasing defense spending and paring back domestic spending with changes to the funding levels for lots of individual programs, though in the end, it's just an overall spending reduction of about $8 billion, which would be a lot of money for me, but is basically nothing in the scheme of government spending.
$8 billion, you know. Any particular programs that you think are worth flagging individually here?
Well, I will say you hear a lot about earmarked special projects that lawmakers champion. There are none of those in this bill, but Immigration and Customs Enforcement would see some more money going their way. Also, some more money for WIC, which provides food support for families with low incomes. There are cuts to fundings for the nation's big healthcare research hub, the National Institutes of Health, and programs in the Education Department. But the big thing to understand about all the fiddling with the numbers here is that it's an indication that House Republicans don't think they'll need House Democrats' help on this. That's Republican Speaker Mike Johnson thinks he can get it done with just Republican votes, but he's got a tiny margin for error.
And that's worth underscoring. We were talking like one vote margin of error.
That's right. He can lose a single Republican vote. And in past go-rounds, that would have been a gamble. Johnson had to rely over and over on Democratic votes to keep the engine running. But these changes are designed to appeal to this subset of anti-spending folks in the party, like Representative Thomas Massey of Kentucky. Massey almost always votes against spending bills. He's part of this small but mighty set of congressional Republicans who want to see regular order on spending, aka a fully churned through, debated, negotiated package for 12 separate funding bills for everything in the government,
mm-hmm.
rather than these stopgaps without the flexibility to make big changes. But of course, Trump is pleading with Republicans. He literally put please exclamation point in a post online asking them to, quote, remain united, no dissent on this. And that has a big impact on support.
Look, at the same time, there has been a long track record of Democrats helping Republicans get these bills over the line. Broadly speaking, the Democratic Party is one in which many members believe in the core functions of government, right? Are we sure that Democrats will not help out here?
I'm not totally sure, but I will say I've got this statement here from Rosa DeLauro. She's from Connecticut. She's the top Dem on the Appropriations Committee. And here's how it starts. I strongly oppose this full year continuing resolution. She calls it a power grab for the White House and further allowing unchecked billionaire Elon Musk and President Trump to steal from the American people. So I'd say it doesn't look like there's a lot of room for collaboration, but the vote will test if Democrats can stick together or if some are unwilling to risk that shutdown like you were talking about.
One other thing that's always worth flagging. This is just one step in a multi-step process, and things could change in any one of those steps.
Right. And in the Senate, Republican Majority Leader John Thune will absolutely need Democratic votes. The chamber has a de facto threshold of 60 votes to pass most legislation. Republicans have 53 seats, so he'll need to pick up 7 Democrats at least. And that could be pretty hard, given the reaction we've seen so far. As former President Biden often says, lots of luck in your senior year.
That is NPR's Eric McDaniel. Thanks for coming by.
A pleasure, Scott.
This is NPR News.
The White House is in a budget-cutting mindset. Mayors are worried about what that means for their cities.
Now is not the time to turn our back on seniors. Now is not the time to turn our back on veterans. Now is not the time to turn our back on our students.
Cleveland Mayor Justin Bibb on federal spending policies and the impact of potential cuts. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Schiavone with these headlines. The Vatican says Pope Francis is responding well to therapy for double pneumonia. Doctors report the Pope has been stable with no fever and good oxygen levels in his blood. The Trump administration's wide-ranging federal workforce cuts have not spared the National Weather Service. Weather experts say that cuts to the agency's Alaska-based staff are already making forecasts less accurate around the world. Most Americans are setting their clocks ahead this weekend, adding more evening sunlight, one of the glories of the approaching spring and summertime. About 70 countries currently observe what Americans call daylight saving time. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. When the Eaton fires burned thousands of homes in Altadena, in many cases, the only thing left standing was a chimney. And many of those chimneys were adorned with fireplace tiles from more than a century ago. Evan Jacoby with LAS News reports.
On Palm Street in Altadena, a home that once stood behind a lush courtyard is now a blackened jumble of rubble and stray nails. You enter through what would have been a wall, but the chimney is still standing.
I'm Cliff Douglas, and we're removing some of the Batchelder Art Deco tiles that survived the fires.
Douglas is one of the co-founders of a volunteer group called Save the Tiles. In the 1920s, when Altadena was growing rapidly, some of the biggest tile makers in the American arts and crafts movement, like Ernest Batchelder, were designing tiles for fireplaces in new construction.
Devin, I need you to hold the bottom of the deco, and she's going to hold the front.
Here, you want both of
these,
right?
Yeah, I need my tools.
Altadena is currently in the second phase of its cleanup, where the Army Corps of Engineers will scour each lot down to the topsoil.
Without intervention, bulldozers will clear everything you see here.
This is Eric Garland, another co-founder of Save the Tiles.
And when they do, what will be lost is not only the very last of old Altadena, but for that homeowner, emotionally priceless artwork. You know, we're hearing from so many homeowners, if you could save even one tile, it would be the only thing I have left.
Dozens of volunteers have helped map where all these historic tiles are and are now helping remove them.
They're beautiful pieces of art, and we're just trying to bring them back to life again.
But Cliff says it's not easy work, even for a skilled mason. Chimneys can be unstable and tiles are prone to cracking. There's an art and a science to safely removing them.
The art is just trying to be able to feel the tile. Listen with your ears. Is it hollow behind it? Is it solid? Is it coming loose? Is it starting to pull away? The science is, gosh, just a lot of trial and error.
The homeowners, Carrie Lewis and Christophe Besset, have the blueprints for this original craftsman home. they hope to build it back as best they can, including the fireplace.
It won't be identical because we will no longer be able to do a wood-burning fireplace, but it'll look the same.
So maybe it'll be, you know, a bit of new and a bit of really ancient coming back together.
For NPR News, I'm Evan Jacoby in Altadena.
It is a trail so big and so long that it's far wider than Texas. It doesn't exist yet, but Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan says eventually it will be a trail that will take people from nearly sea level to the top of Texas and everywhere in between.
A nonprofit is designing a 1,500-mile walking trail across Texas that they're calling the X-Tex. Many parts of the country have long walking trails, but the Lone Star State doesn't.
You know, this trail is the TxDOT engineer's worst nightmare because there's no straight lines in it. It maneuvers about with the contour of the land.
This is all Charlie Gandy's idea, and TxDOT is the Texas Department of Transportation whose long straight freeways cross the state. Gandy's designed a curlicue route, which nearly doubles the 850 miles of I-10's east-to-west traverse.
This is the dirty route across Texas. It's the toughest, hardest, dirtiest route.
Gandy says that there's a lot of Texas that nearly no one's ever seen. And here's why. 93% of Texas is privately owned.
Well, you know what? There's some secrets out there. This is hidden Texas.
He says he's taking existing infrastructure, quiet back roads through counties, state and national parks, and linking them together. Here's the planned route.
From Quicksand Creek on the Louisiana border, through the pine forest, out into the hill country.
The trail then cuts west through the craggy oak-covered limestone hills.
Then down into Big Bend, and then up to Penny Ferguson's ranch, which is just south of Marfa. And then into Marfa, the Soho of Western Texas. And then up to the highest peak in the state, Guadalupe Peak, and then on over to El Paso.
Out west, county and state parks are fewer and further between, so much of the route goes through private ranches, including Penny Ferguson's in Presidio County.
The overall acreage of the ranch is around 20,000 acres for cattle ranching purposes. You need about 10 acres per cow.
Like most out here, having a ranch doesn't actually make her wealthy.
We are what everyone has always called land rich and money poor. So it's been handed down through, interestingly enough, through the women for the last three generations.
In this family, it's the women who have run the ranch. Most Texas ranchers lease to deer hunters to augment the little they make on cattle. Leasing can add 30 to 50 grand per season, and so Ferguson looks to find new revenue streams as raising cattle becomes less profitable. She's turned her old ranch headquarters into an Airbnb and looks forward to the people she'll meet on the X-Tex.
I think a lot of them are people who are interested in history and interested in learning and very curious and open-minded, and those are all welcome things.
Gandy only unveiled the X-Tex 6 months ago, but he's finding more and more ranchers like Ferguson. On Monday, he's walking the first 100 miles of it.
March the 10th, a Monday morning, 7 a.m. at Quicksand Creek on the Louisiana border, will be taken off on horses, on mountain bikes, and hiking.
Gandy thinks he's not so much building a trail as creating some magic.
We like to think that we're rebooting Texas here.
He wants to see the adventurous get out and challenge themselves.
Because in that is learning. In that is slowing down, getting out of reach of the cell phones, and listening to the voices in your mind. There is some magic in that, and that's what we're creating.
If the X-Tex gets built, it'll join the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail in the top 10 longest in the nation. I'm Jack Morgan near the route for the X-Tex in Burney, Texas.
Jason Isbell likes to challenge himself. More specifically,
you know, I like to give myself some rules.
The singer and songwriter has a new album out this week, and it's different. His first all-acoustic solo effort. That's intentional.
So the rule was just you and an acoustic guitar, that's the rule?
Yeah, no overdubs, no harmonies, nothing like that. Just I had to be playing it and singing it at the same time. I wound up recording a record in New York, and I wanted to walk into a studio in the Village with a single guitar and a notebook and come out of there with an album, like people used to do in the 60s.
Started out like it always starts. Try to hold the hunger back. You don't anticipate a broken heart. Can't see nothing but the track.
The result? a stripped-down album of songs that often feel personal. Now, the songs Isbell writes have always felt pretty personal. It's a big part of his appeal. But coming in the wake of a recent divorce, songs about the angry pain and second-guessing that come with breakups, and songs about the thrills of new relationships, the topics stand out. The new album is called Foxes in the Snow. When Isbell stopped by the NPR studios the other day, I started by asking him about that evocative image.
I like her friend, the ones I know. And they leave drops of blood like foxes in the snow.
It came out of, I think, the idea of holding two concepts in your mind at once. That things can be really, 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 really bad and difficult and challenging, and still you can have an infinite amount of gratitude. Mm-hmm. You know, politically, socially, culturally, you know, you got to be able to pay attention. Like, I'm not going to turn the news off, but I got to stay on the right side of that point of diminishing returns. I can't just curl up in a ball and think the world sucks and America's awful and we're all going to die.
Yeah.
So I have to keep that gratitude in my mind at the same time. And, you know, foxes in the snow is you know, a fox is a dangerous animal. And when I lived out in the country, we had chickens, you know, and every couple of days I'd be out yelling at a fox in the front yard and be headed toward the chicken coop. And it's not the fox's fault, it's a fox,
yeah.
You know. And
they're increasingly my favorite animal. They're so beautiful.
They're so beautiful, but they're vicious. And that's the thing. You hold those two things in your mind at the same time, that your life and also yourself, your situation, your circumstances, but your choices can be very beautiful and also very vicious simultaneously.
Could have been all the fights I didn't win. They put me here against her skin. She can see me.
You touched on politics a little there, and I wanted to ask you about that because you're somebody who, whether it's social media or sometimes in your performances or in your music, you performed at the Democratic Convention last year. Mm-hmm. You're a politically active person. It's kind of a weird political time right now, and I think a lot of artists are choosing to be less political than they were before.
Yeah.
How are you thinking about this moment?
Choosing is doing a lot of work there, because for some of us, it's more of a choice than it is for others.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are some people who are afraid, and they're afraid that if they speak out, then it's going to be even more difficult for them to feed themselves, feed their families, and keep doing the work they want to do. For me, I don't have a whole lot of fear of that. I know there's enough people out there that are going to continue to consume the work that I'm making. It's going to be fine for me, so I feel motivated to say more. You know, it's terrible. You know, Trump's terrible. He's a terrible leader. He's a terrible person. This is a terrible time. And it's easy for me to say.
People are still going to come to your shows. People are still going to listen to your music.
Yeah, nobody's going to come up and punch me in the face, you know. I mean, maybe they will, but good luck, you know. I'm pretty far left, but I got a good right, so good luck. But yeah, the truth of it is I feel very strongly for a lot of people who aren't in those circumstances, and it's so hard to break through and make a living making music now as it is.
Everything's green right now, Tennessee at the end of June. You get a day to come down, we'll ride Roberts in the afternoon.
Can we talk about the songwriting for a little bit?
Yes, please.
You came on All Things Considered right before Southeastern came out, which is a really interesting moment to hear you talk about things right before this big defining album, you know, hits the world. And you were talking about how personal so many of these songs are. And you were talking about the songwriting process. And you said, it's really hard to write a really personal song. It's a visceral experience. You're putting yourself out there. You've been doing that for 10 years since you said that. Has that changed over the decade?
It's still difficult.
Yeah.
But I think I keep it difficult. I think I make steps to keep it hard, you know?
Like what?
Like, I keep revealing things that I don't feel comfortable revealing. And,
yeah.
And like, when I finished this record, I called my best friend. I said, am I crazy? Like, is this nuts? This feels so uncomfortable to me. And he said, no. If you didn't have that question, you wouldn't be doing your job. That's your job. It's not everybody's job, but it's yours. And the one that you've committed to and the way that you relate to your work and to the rest of the world. So, yeah, you have to let those things out. But I don't think it's gotten any easier. I don't know that it's supposed to.
You know, if I ever make an album and I don't look back at the end and think, oh my God, I've revealed too much, then I feel like I probably haven't made an album that I should sell and tour.
You're giving an opening there because I do want to ask you about some of those things that you feel like you might have revealed too much of. Uh-huh. One particular song I wanted to ask about, Gravel Weed.
Yeah. Wish that I could be angry, punch a hole in the wall, drink a fifth of cheap whiskey and call and call and call.
I feel like a lot of your fans are going to hear that song, hear the chorus in particular, and hear that song as almost, it's a bookend song, the end of a relationship song, and talking about love songs that hit different now than before.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to hear that and think about the big changes in your life.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I'm sure. And, you know, I think the truth is always forgiving. If I'm telling the truth and I'm doing it in the right way, then it means I'm zooming out far enough to get past bitterness. You still have anger. You can still be sad. But like Tom T. Hall said in his songwriting book, you know, if you're bitter, you're showing your own hand. You're weakening the perspective of the narrator in the song. And I think you're weakening your own perspective in your life. And now that I live to see my melodies betray me, I'm sorry the love songs all mean different things today. There are things about the relationship that I'm grateful for, you know, big changes that happened in my life. Things would not have gone the same way if anything had been different. That's just how it always goes. But I just try to be honest about it, and I try to be, I try to zoom out a little bit and get past any kind of resentment and look at it for what it was and what it is. Don't be tough until you have to. Take your heartbreak on the chin.
A few times in this conversation, you've talked about looking back. And I'm wondering, you look back when a relationship is over, and so much, at least to outsiders' perspective, so much of your heart and soul of that relationship lives in different lyrics of songs.
Yeah.
No regret about that at this point?
No, I don't think so. No regret about the songs. No regret about that. The thing that I wish that people understood is this is not a true crime podcast. And it seems like more now than ever before, because we're all in contact with each other.
Yeah.
People feel like they can connect the dots and they can come up with some kind of story. And that's not what art is. That's not what songwriting is. Because, you know, songs are not arranged that way. We can take pieces and images and parts of stories and move them around and put them wherever we want to put them, and there's no fiction or nonfiction shelf in the record store. And I think the mistake happens when people listen and start trying to connect the dots. But that's not my responsibility. That's not my job. You know, my job is to make these images, these narratives, these pictures happen. The song exists separately from my life. Of course, both of them feed each other. But this is not my diary. I'm a songwriter. I mean, I guess people need a mystery to solve.
Well, that's why those podcasts are so popular.
Those podcasts are doing big numbers. I should have done a murder podcast.
There's always the next day. That's Jason Isbell. The new album is called Foxes in the Snow. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming by.
And if you want it, go and get it. Don't just pray and wait around. Life will kill you if you live.
That's All Things Considered for this Saturday. I'm Scott Detrow. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you again tomorrow night.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. From the Cy Simms Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.